Hello, and welcome to how Microsoft IT uses System Center 2012 Config Manager. I'm Arun Ramakrishnan. I'm a service engineer at Microsoft IT. And with me, I have Mark Hurley.
Hi, I'm also a system engineer at Microsoft. I work on Arun's team with him. I run a service side of the product while Arun runs the platform side of the product. We're actual hands-on engineers like you guys, so this isn't a discussion that's coming from the product team or a marketing group. We're day-to-day admins, so we welcome any questions you have throughout the presentation. If you want more clarification or something you want to hear about, feel free. Please try and go up to one of the microphones, though, because this room has quite an echo, so it'll be hard for us to hear what you're asking unless you're talking through one of the mics. And we both had mints after lunch, so you feel free to move closer down if you want. But it's okay if you want to stay in the back to go to sleep.
All right. So our session objective, like Mark mentioned, we're actually real-life admins. We have a service to Microsoft IT where we have KPIs and SLAs that we're held accountable to. And we're going to share our experiences with SP1, how we evaluated different features that are available in SP1 implemented in our environment. And during this presentation, we're also going to talk about, like, you know, there are some new features in SP1 that we evaluated but did not implement in our environment. So it's like, you know, we're a business like anywhere else. Even though the product has given us a lot of great features, we haven't implemented everything in our environment. We've done an evaluation like you would in your environment, and we're going to share our story and our learnings and hope that you come away with stuff that you can use in your environment. So some of the key items that we're going to cover, the first one you're going to be surprised, why is Orchestrator here? The reason we're going to talk about Orchestrator is we actually did a zero-touch upgrade throughout our SP1 lifecycle. We actually had several versions of SP1 upgrade in our production environment before we hit RTM, and we used like a completely unattended and automated upgrade process. So that's why we have the Orchestrator runbooks here. We'll briefly cover about the Intune connector and unified device management. Show of hands, how many folks have attended other sessions which talk about the Intune connector and the unified device management? So that's a fairly big percentage. So we're not going to bore you to death. It's just going to be a high-level touch. Like, you know, these are things we've done. We have another session that we'll also talk about during this presentation. We'll do some self-promotion as well. We're going to talk about automatic deployment. That's Mark's favorite topic. We're going to show you some demo on how it's made our life easier. So we have managed about 300,000 PCs at Microsoft, and we're going to talk about how automatic deployment has really made our life so much easier from getting those clients upgraded at each build. User-centric application delivery, some changes in software update lists that folks might be interested in, and Mac management. Show of hands, how many folks have Macs in their environment? Wow, significant amount. So you'd be really interested in this topic. All right. And modern application distribution. So quick overview of what the Microsoft IT infrastructure looks like. If folks haven't seen this slide being done to death in other presentations, I promise I won't spend a lot of time on this. We have about 300,000 PCs, like we said, at Microsoft, and we have five major primary sites split across different geographic locations based on user population. We also have we've recently built a dedicated primary site just for device management. This is based on our current, like, you know, the current load split across our different existing primary sites, and the evaluation we've done based on exchange data and on figuring out, like, you know, we have about 100,000 full-time employees, another 80,000 vendors, and we have, based on exchange data, at least 125,000 devices that are using Exchange today to connect to email. So we kind of estimated, even though you could have we could have set up device management on an existing primary site with which is already supporting PCs. We thought it would be a more conservative decision on our side to have a dedicated primary site to see how things evolve. Let's touch on the orchestrator runbook. So we talked about doing a zero-touch installation in our environment. We actually built a orchestrator runbook. This was back in August of last year, where we had a challenge where we were going through the earlier builds of SP1, and we were upgrading our entire config manager environment, which you saw, the five primary sites and the multiple secondary sites and distribution points that we have underneath. And we wanted a solution that would be zero touch for us. We didn't want to have to go through in previous build, when we did the actual config manager 2012 RTM, we were doing the same things as probably most folks are doing in this room. We were walking through the wizard. It would take, really long time. Stuff would get missed because, we have a lot of items documented, but documents are not always followed. By being able to use this automation and orchestrator, it helped us. We had a lot of, scripts that did minor things, did single things. By using this orchestrator runbook, it helped us stitch together the entire process so that we could run the entire process end-to-end without having a lot of user intervention. It would be a little zero-touch. All our admins had to do, or analysts had to do, was monitor logs and make sure things progress from stage one to the next stage.
And we've got a presentation that we did on Wednesday, so unfortunately, if you guys didn't show up to it, you missed it, but it's available on the recording right now. That session goes in really, really deep dive detail on this whole solution that we developed and actually provides you all the scripts that we've used to solve this problem so that you can take those back to your company and try them out in the lab. And it may help you get upgraded if you're still on RTM and you haven't moved to SP1, or even for your planning on future R2 release.
Yeah, and the solution that we built is like a framework on top of Orchestrator, where it's not dependent on any technology. You can use it on SCCM 2007 if you wish, if you have scripts already that do stuff there. You can do it for WSS related. If you have a non-config manager related application, you can even use it there. We just wanted to share this information. Like we said, we're going to do some shameless self-promotion during this presentation. So this session, if you don't have your time machine, go to channel 9 and you can watch this session, which gives you more detail about the runbook and more specific details about what we've managed to accomplish. Some of the upgrade tasks that we've managed to accomplish, I'm sure you all do this in your environment every time you have to upgrade, being able to do the TestDB upgrade, just backing up the database and restoring it onto a different machine to run that process, backing up your old logs, copying the bits, and the simple tasks that are not limited to just an upgrade task. You could potentially have that happen even when you're doing a new site build in your environment. So please do watch this recording. We have a quiz, a short quiz. How long did you think it took us to upgrade with this automated solution? Seeing we shared that how big our environment is, how long do you think it took for us to upgrade our environment?
Yeah, not that it's leading by putting 24 hours down there. So in literally, before we developed automation, we would do a full site upgrade about every 6 weeks or so. And every time the product team released a new build internally, we would dog food this. So the whole hierarchy, all site servers, all 300,000 desktops had to be upgraded. It would take us a good week.
It would take us a week. It would take us a week and upwards. And like you say, our service, our stakeholders were not happy. But thanks to this solution, we were able to upgrade our hierarchy in 24 hours. So that's one of the key lessons learned that we had for SP1 that we're going to carry forward to R2, as well as if you can automate something, get it done. Next, we're going to talk about a specific feature. So show of hands, how many folks actually are already on SP1 in their environment? Well, that's a significant, it's like 30-40%. Has anybody looked at the Cloud DP solution yet? One person. Have you implemented it, sir, in your environment?
In a test
environment, okay. We're on the same boat as you. We did it in the test environment as well, because we didn't really find a suitable location at Microsoft, which would kind of meet the business needs. But we do have a better understanding of the kind of business scenarios where a Cloud DP could be applied. So Cloud DP, for those folks not familiar, is a new feature available in SP1 where you can have a distribution point in Azure. What it does is it creates a storage account and a web front ends for your where you can store content and where your clients would essentially communicate with. It will act like a standard DP. Clients would get, as part of their, like, you know, from the management point, they would get the list of DPs for any particular package they're trying to access. They would get information on whether the content's available on a Cloud DP. There are certain fallback policies that apply to Cloud DP. So typically, a client will only pull content from a Cloud DP if it doesn't find it on the any local DP or any remote DP on premise. Some of the pros that we've managed, there's a lot of fear that, hey, if I put my content on Azure, is the content safe? So we can ensure you that the content, the URL locations for the blob storage that are handed out to the clients are encrypted. So there's no security concern there. And one of the key advantages that Cloud DP offers is, you know, Cloud DP can be scaled up and down based on your requirement. So you could theoretically, of course we haven't tested this either, is you could have a Cloud DP service an entire region, not just like a particular location. In theory, you could have, you know, if you have multiple pockets within a particular geographical region, you could have Cloud DP service them. So one caveat that folks need to be aware of, Cloud DP is only for software distribution content. It's not for patches, because for patches, we already have Microsoft Update, and there is a feature where you can fail over to Microsoft Update. So it would be redundant to have that content republished into Windows Azure. And another key advantage that Cloud DP offers is Cloud DP works with branch cache. So if folks are worried about, if I have my content stored in Azure, and is it going to, you know, am I going to get a really big Azure bill at the end of the day? The answer is no, because it works with branch cache, and the admin actually has quite a bit of granular control on, you know, you can set for storage size, you can control the storage size from the Config Manager console on how much content is stored into Azure. And at the same time, you can also do a number of I/O transactions that happen with your Azure instances. So the cons from our side, which kind of was the main deal breaker for us in not implementing it, from a network standpoint, Microsoft has a fairly, you know, we've invested a lot in actually building reliable networks across our field offices. So we didn't really find a lot of scenarios where we had a location which had an independent network connection and they could potentially use this. So we're still waiting for a network team to see if they come up with some re-architecture within the next few years that we could potentially apply this to. Another thing is it does not support PXIe and OSD today and AppV streaming. So at Microsoft, Config Manager is the main mechanism for performing OSD in our environment, and that's why we decided not to implement Cloud DP in a wide scale. So if you want to read more about it, there's a blog post available that's linked into this presentation that you should look into, and it may be definitely a scenario if you feel this applies to your environment. One key scenario or location that we feel that you could apply it to is, like I said, if you have, like, you know, remote branch offices that it's too expensive to host a distribution point or to have an admin go to that place, then a Cloud DP would be a very good alternate solution for you there. So how many folks have NLB or load balancing set up for the software update points in their environment?
Nobody.
That's a really handful. Okay. In Microsoft, actually, we had our WSUS servers were behind a software load balancer, network load balancer. And It's a critical thing for us because we use WCS-based client publishing. So WCS-based client installation is the primary mechanism for us for pushing clients onto our target environment. So that's why in SP1 there was a re-architecture. They kind of came up with this concept of sublist. So folks are familiar, hope, with the MP list concept in that we have in 2012 RTM. So they came up with a similar inbuilt load balancing algorithm for software update points as well. That became a little bit of a challenge for us because we were stamping the GPO. In GPO, we were stamping the WSUS URL on all our clients, and we were stamping the URL of the NLB WIP or the NLB DNS name. So if we stamped the information of, and we would have been forced to stamp the information of an individual client, and we were not sure if clients would start going to the same software update point each time and overload one particular software update point. So that's why this is something we did not implement in our environment. And one of the caveats and challenges that we came upon is earlier in the Config Manager console, you had the ability to configure the network load balancer for a software update point. It's no longer a feature that's available directly from the console. You have to do something, like if you're upgrading from 2012 to SP1, you have to kind of deprecate the load balancer by having just a single active software update point in your environment. And post-upgrade, there is a PowerShell commandlet that's available out of box that you can run to set up the NLB. And we'll talk more about in the next slide about specific steps that you would have to perform in order to set this up in your environment. By the way, if folks want to read more about this, the algorithm behind the native software update load balancing, then please refer to this document linked here. So let's do a quick walkthrough. So you have a 2012 environment and you want to update from 2012 to SP1 and you have an NLB currently, or if you're thinking about having an NLB or hardware-based load balancer at a later point in time, what are the steps that you would have to perform? So step number one is remove the existing load balancer, as we talked about, and you would have to deprecate it to have a single active software update point. Then post SP1 upgrade, you can reconfigure the NLB. Of course, you cannot do it through the wizard or the console. You can do it through the PowerShell commandlets. There are like 400 plus PowerShell commandlets that are available in Config Manager SP1, and it is really robust. We'll give you the specific command line parameters. The commandlet you need is the setcm updates point. And we're providing the exact command line parameters that you need to use for setting up this NLB post-implementation. Now, another challenge is there's no way to validate whether from the console itself if the NLB WIP was set up correctly. So we're also going to provide you with a SQL query that you can run against your database to confirm if the NLB was set up correctly.
So before we move on to the next slide, if you'll see point number three, connect Windows PowerShell via Config Manager console, really that's kind of a tip for you in that if you open up a PowerShell window just on your desktop to try and run these commands, they're going to fail because you haven't loaded the CM commandlet, the modules. If you go into your admin console and click on the drop-down arrow, connect via Windows PowerShell icons there, that actually will launch a command shell window for you that has the modules preloaded. So then you can just start running scripts. So it's something to just keep in mind when you're doing scripting.
Yeah.
It looks like we've got a question.
That's also running in the context of the site server versus your own.
It's running under your admin role. So if whatever administrative rights that you have within the RBAC roles that you've set up for your hierarchy, you'll be able to take those actions using the commandlets that are provided. So yeah, you won't get elevated permissions by launching that from the console.
And if you do decide to, if you want to write scripts and don't want to launch it from the console, it's at the PowerShell command from the console itself, the module file is actually in the admin directory under the x86 folder. And one caveat is this PowerShell, the config manager out-of-box PowerShell command, let's only run in the x86 version of the x86 version of PowerShell in SP1.
And we've got a link at the end of the slide deck that will take you right to the location where you can download that information. And so that'll be available after the presentation for you guys to get a copy of this deck with all the details.
With that, I hand off to Mark to talk about client upgrade experience.
Okay. So as we talked about, we've got 300,000 desktops. And with us upgrading the hierarchy every 6 weeks, although we created orchestrator automation to upgrade the actual infrastructure, the primary sites and the secondary sites and DPs and MP roles and everything, which was great, we still had to roll the client out. And how we use Software Update Point to maintain our clients in the environment, so somebody that comes in with a new machine, they'll automatically get the client because the Software Update Point says it's almost treats it like a patch and says you should have the client. We can't leave that active when we upgrade the site because all of a sudden we would have 300,000 desktops all attacking our Software Update Points, management points with data and basically crush the system. So we've got to turn that off and then go through a process that I think many configuration manager admins are familiar with, which is use software deployment to update clients, which is functional, but it takes a lot of heavy lifting. You're building custom collections, you're setting up deployments, you're monitoring to see how many are successful, and you're doing this on a scale that would take us anywhere from a week to 2.5 weeks to get that completed, only to turn around in a few more weeks and start all over again. So one of the cool new features that's available in SP1 is automatic client upgrades. So this will help you out if you're moving from RTM to SP1, and then again in the future, if you're moving to R2. We'll talk about basically what happens is the clients get a checkbox that you set in the hierarchy level, and I'll show you in the demo, and it enables a hidden deployment that's already staged as part of SP1 rollout to your environment. So all the clients then are just being activated to say, we want you to do this automatic upgrade. You pick how many days you want it to take for the upgrade to happen in your environment, and it randomizes the process for you end to end. So it's really a one-click solution for you as an administrator, and then you just monitor the deployment. And what we do is once we hit about 85 to 90% client compliance in our environment, then we'll turn back on the Software Update Point client installation. So the key benefits of this are provide a simple and automatic method for you to upgrade. We always make sure that the clients then are remaining at a baseline level, so the baseline level of the client for the entire hierarchy, so you don't have to worry about managing what version your clients are going to get. That happens automatically. And if you happen to have hot fixes or client updates that you need to do in between the cycle, those can be deployed through the automatic update process as well. So you're just updating the content location where the client is, and that will revision the minimum version for you and get those deployed out for you in the same method. This is basically what it'll look like in the console, but instead of just talking about it, let's dive in and take a look at what it looks like. Too many slides, more demo, right? So here we go. This is a demo site. This isn't our giant hierarchy because I don't want to mess around with that. But essentially, you would set this role at the highest level in your hierarchy. So if you only have a single standalone primary site, that's where you would set the setting. But if you have a CAS and multiple primaries below that, you set it at the CAS level. So it's a hierarchy-wide setting. It's not each individual site. So once you turn it on, it's active across the board for your whole site. So we'd click on hierarchy settings. We go to this new tab called Automatic Client Upgrade. When you check the checkbox, it's basically saying you're determining that you want to turn this on, and are you sure? So it gives you the option to cancel out if you change your mind. But we're going to click OK. And here's where you basically decide how many days you want it to take. So if you want to be aggressive, you can go ahead and leave it at 3 days. But for 300,000 clients, we generally set it to 10. And I'll show you some screenshots in a little bit that show exactly what it looks like. So I'm going to set this to 2.
So is the recommendation that always set it to 10 days, depending, or is it based on the load on your environment?
It's based on your environment, your specific environment. So the expectation is you should have some idea as the admin how you normally do your client rollout and what your infrastructure can handle. And so it's good for you to be more conservative and set a longer date in order to not aggressively attack your system with a bunch of clients updating. But you'll be amazed at the images that we can show you on how well the randomization happens automatically for you to make sure that the load occurs across the full complement of days that you've set. So it's very good what the team came up with to make sure that clients get completely randomized in a nice, even fashion so that your deployments happen 24 hours each day, very randomized. So prior to setting up the automatic client upgrade, if you look in the task scheduler on a client, all that's in there right now for the configuration manager node is the client health evaluation. Once I go in, so I've set it up on the hierarchy and it's enabled the policy to say, go ahead and trigger off the client upgrade. This will, look at how fast that was. Refreshed, and what it did is it created a scheduled task that's picked a randomized time, and this is how the machine is going to be woken up and told, hey, I need you to do a client upgrade. If your machine's already at the proper level, this will run, but it'll detect that your client's already up to date and just exit out. It'll clean itself up. It won't run again. If you happen to be offline when this schedule hits, when you wake up, when your machine comes back online, it'll run immediately. If you happen to have your machine offline the full cycle, so say you set 10 days and a machine's been away for 2 weeks, as soon as it gets back on the network, it will get randomized over the next 24-hour period so that you don't have a whole bunch of machines that maybe come back on a Monday morning and then they all start running. They'll give you a 24-hour grace period automatically, which is really cool. So if we look at the log, it hasn't updated.
I think it did, right? It's a minute ago.
All right. Well, the logs haven't updated for the client. So while that's happening, I'll show you this query. So this package that sets up the scheduled task is completely hidden. So it's not something that you can manage on your own. This comes out of the box when you install SP1. If you want to take a look at it, you can run this query to see that the package exists. And the actual client upgrade package, although it's visible to you in the console, it's not something that you mess with. It's automatically deployed out to your DPs. It will automatically run with the last command line for CCM setup that was run when the existing client installed. So you don't get to change any command line parameters. It's going to run the command line that was the last successful one that CCM set up when that machine got its first client installed. So it's really zero touch from your perspective, just a checkbox. So let's go back to the slide. Does anybody have any questions about that? It's pretty seamless, cool to use. So if we go back quickly over the tasks, you're enabling the checkbox. The systems then will enable the policy that's already sitting on them to create that scheduled task. What happens is CCM setup EXE runs with a new command line switch called auto upgrade, and that's really what generates the process to wake this up. And again, it's nothing that you have to control or manage. It's just happening in the background. R2 will be the same, yes. If anything, we don't know yet because we just got the first build this week, but there may be additional cool features that are added. But right now, the expectation is the auto upgrade will work the exact same way. So if, say, you're going straight from 2012 RTM and waiting for R2, you'll be able to still take advantage of the same behavior. So once the scheduled task runs, it just kicks back CCM setup, make sure that the client's up to date, and if it is, puts the cab file into the cache folder, deletes the scheduled task, and you're done. You're up to date. So as I was mentioning, this is an example of what the randomization looked like in our environment when we first used this the first time. So we had set it for randomization for 10 days. And as you can see, of our 300,000 roughly clients that we have, it's got a pretty good random schedule set up there. So these are per day. How many clients in total per day are going to run the install? Here's an example. We drilled down on a specific day, roughly around 7 o'clock at night. So you'll see the clients from earlier in the day, there's less of a randomization. Those are actually the machines that were offline during their scheduled time. So all of the rest of the machines had already run, but at 7 o'clock, you can see it's still really even randomization for the machines that are going to remain and run on an hourly basis. And even within each of those hour pillars, the clients are randomized to the second. So it really is a great algorithm that they designed that you get an automatic randomization that you don't have to worry about, so it won't overload your system. So it depends really. He was asking how many clients can operate this randomization install at the same time before you see a performance problem. It really depends on your infrastructure that you have built. The components are already downloaded onto the machines. So as part of the whole randomization process, the clients are all ready to go. Now, if you happen to not have distribution points that were active, the clients will fall back to their assigned management point to get the bits. So there is that risk if you aren't properly managing your distribution points and they go offline and there's a bunch of clients at that site that can't communicate to another DP, then they will hit the management point in order to get the content. But we saw no performance impact.
We haven't seen any performance impact because of this. In the past, we have seen impact with the software distribution process. And the software distribution process was fairly painful because, you know, the admin would distribute, then we had to manage, and then we would add the next set of clients to be targeted. With this, it has been a fairly seamless experience.
And the actual install is across
100% success? Yes, there's always the potential that there's some corrupt problem with the operating system or something, but if you've got a healthy client on the endpoint, then the automatic client upgrade, we haven't seen any failures. We don't get anything back to the fallback status point showing us issues.
We've had fairly good success ratios with this process.
Yeah. So here's some noteworthy items. I've covered a few of them when we were talking. One key note, if the client's on a slower, unreliable network, if that's how you've set up the boundary that those machines are always on that, it's not going to run the process. So it's not going to force the machine to go across a slow network to download content. So those machines will wait until they're back on a fast boundary to be upgraded. So if they never come back on, that would be something that will be caught when you turn back on software update point installation. So we're going to move on to application management. So this is the team that I run back at Microsoft. And what we're going to focus on today, because this seems to be the key topic that is of real interest recently, is the modern device management. So how many people went and got RT devices? A lot of people. So back in November when Surface released, Microsoft employees got a Surface, and we had a huge inundation of Surface devices into our environment. We also got hooked up with the Phone 8s, so now we've got all of these modern devices that we never used to have to manage before. Now we have to manage them. Arun and I did a session earlier this morning that went into a lot more detail on how to take advantage of your on-premise config manager environment connected to Intune in order to manage these devices through the single config manager console pane of glass. So if you're interested in that, that recording is available again. We'll do some shameless promotion, but the numbers will be at the end of this slide deck so you can easily find it and watch the recording. But basically what we want to talk about is we have three main devices that we really focused on in our environment: the Windows RT device, the Windows Phone 8 device, and amazingly enough, we've got a lot of iOS devices. We've got iPads and iPhones in our environment. Now, we don't have a lot of internal development of iOS-based applications. We've got a few, and of course, Skype is a pretty popular one, so we'll use those for deployment. But essentially, it lets us manage internal line of business apps to these devices, which is really what gets the user excited about bringing these devices on premise, is they have access to their internal company apps in order to get them to be able to do day-to-day business work that they normally had to do only on their desktop or laptop. So a lot of people are taking advantage of this. So the key pillars is user-targeted apps. You don't do forced deployment to modern devices. The idea is this is a user's personal device. You make things available to them, and they go out to a company portal, and they install apps just like if they went to the Microsoft Store to install something. There's a company portal both on RT and Phone 8, and iOS also has a portal that looks very similar. So any iOS apps that you publish internally, those are made available. Gives them an area to go to and install instead of having to search for it in Apple's marketplace. How many people have been using deep link apps so far? Does anybody know what deep link app is? Okay, so in 2012, SP1, there's application modeling is the way we do all our application deployment now. So we stopped using the classic method of package and program. We're now using app model end-to-end. A new deployment type that was made available in SP1 is deep link. And what that does is I don't want to have to manage an application like Skype or Link because those apps revision frequently. They're available in the Microsoft Store. So what we can do is internally, I can build an application that's going to be published in our internal company portal that is a link to Skype. So the user will see the app in the portal. It'll look just like it is in the marketplace. And when they click on it to install it, it's going to redirect them out to the Microsoft Store. So they don't, again, have to search for it. And then they can install it from there. The nice thing is Microsoft Store revisions that app. The user gets notified, and the app gets updated. So I no longer have to manage that. But the information of the user triggering the install to go and install it, that comes back to my on-premise configuration manager hierarchy, so I can see how many users are actually using it. So that's pretty cool.
So I had a question on that. So sure. Is that limited just to the Microsoft Store, or it can be done even for the Apple Store, the deep link?
Yeah, the deep link's available so that you can deep link to iOS apps in the Apple Store as well. So the question was, can we deep link to traditional apps? So you're thinking MSI or something. So no, the answer is no. But generally on-premise stuff like MSI or an executable package, those are hosted content on your own internal distribution points. So that management. The deep link really was created in order to make external applications that are hosted outside of your corporation available but managed by your internal company so that users aren't having to go find them if there's something that your company... Sure. Okay, so technically then, if you have internal content that's hosted at the end of a URL, there is a method for you to create a deployment type that will actually trigger that where you are contentless, and you and I can talk about that after if you want to hear more about it, or anybody else that's interested. So the key takeaway from the end on the in-console deployment monitoring is for all of these modern apps, although the devices are connected to Intune in the cloud, they're not connected to your corporate network. All of the application management, their inventory, policies that you set for them, all of that's done from your on-premise config manager console, and all of the reporting and data comes back to your on-premise console as though they were a managed device on-prem. So you get all the same information. You don't have to build custom reports for these. All of the in-console information about app deployment and management, all the same. So we'll talk about Windows 8 sideloading requirements. So how many people know what sideloading means? Okay, good, good. So essentially, that's the way that you can get a modern app, a Windows 8 application, onto your device through a enterprise tool. So Configuration Manager, for example. So the requirements for this on a Windows 8 enterprise client SKU. So we're talking about enterprise or ultimate, not professional. Machine's got to be domain joined, or you're going to have to get the sideloading key added to it. We use a GPO internally in order to enable trusted apps, and so it makes it easy for us for on-premise Windows 8 enterprise machines to get it. For the other client SKUs, like Pro or Windows RT, those need a side-loading key. Now, if you're connecting to Intune through the Config Manager and Intune hybrid connection, the side-loading key is something that you register as part of the enrollment to that service. So when the RT device enrolls in and becomes managed, that side-loading key gets pushed down to the device. So it's something that you don't have to do.
But the side-loading key is used, you get a new side-loading key every time you enroll the device. So if you constantly unenroll and re-enroll, you're going to use up your side-loading keys pretty quickly, and they run pretty expensive.
Yeah. The one thing that we've seen a lot internally is some of the people coming in with their own Windows 8 Pro device, so not an RT, but a Windows 8 Pro, maybe they bought it at a retail store, and they've brought it on-premise, and they think by getting the Config Manager client on Pro, now I'm going to have access to install all my line of business apps like I do on my enterprise machine. There is no method through Config Manager to support those Pro devices unless you develop another method to get the side-loading keys installed. So we basically have determined internally for us, we're not going to manage those. We tell the users, please re-image to the corporate image, which will be enterprise, and then you'll get the applications available to you. So that's just something for you to note if you have a lot of Pro devices in your environment. Server SKUs don't really have anything special required other than enabling the group policy to allow trusted apps to install. So are people building Windows 8 line of business apps internally here? Do you guys have a lot of developers that are building them yet? Okay, not so much. So we've got a lot. I mean, we have probably well up over 100 internal apps right now. So a lot of stuff that used to be maybe a web portal-based application internally, the developers are now developing Windows 8 modern applications that will install on the desktop and use the same back-end service, but now the application has a cool front end for Windows 8. The process in order to get these fully functional end-to-end is that the developers have to build these apps under certain criteria that meet Windows 8 requirements. So when they download the Windows 8 developer kit and SDK, there is a certification process that they have to run their application through to make sure that it'll actually function in Windows 8 properly as a modern app. At that time, they have to sign the application in order for it to be trusted and run. They may have an internal developer certificate that they're using for this process. When you go to deploy it, you need to make sure that the certificate matches on the devices. Otherwise, the application won't be seen as trusted and it won't launch. So part of our process, once we certify the app, is we make sure that we re-sign the application with our own internal trusted certificate. What we decided to use for RT was the base root certificate had a child cert created for it, and we pushed the root cert out onto the RT devices, and then we signed the apps with the child cert. So you can spin up as many child certs as you need off of that root cert, and as long as the apps are signed with one of those, when they launch and the root certificate has been pushed to that RT device or pushed to the Pro or to the enterprise SKU, those will run. They'll be trusted. One thing to catch is if your internal CA, you have two, or you have two different certificate routes that you use, you got to be sure that you're only using one to sign your line of business apps. We ran into an issue where we were only doing Windows 8 desktop for about a year, and partway through, the team started signing our applications with another root certificate. Internally, on desktops that are managed on-premise, both of those root certs got pushed down through group policy, so the apps were able to launch, and we didn't see any issue. When we moved to RT, you can only enroll one single certificate as part of that process to have that pushed down to your RT device. What we ended up happening is 50% of our apps ran and launched fine, and the other 50% wouldn't load. So we had to re-sign those other 50 apps again in order to get that to work. So it is something that you want to really keep control over, that once you get this set up, make sure that whoever's signing your apps for you are signing it with the proper certificate. So let's go into a demo. You can tell we're talking too long because the machine keeps locking itself up. All right. So I'll show for people who weren't at the morning session. When I'm talking about publishing the certificate for RT, this is where it basically happens. So as part of the Intune subscription, when you connect and you enable Windows RT for your environment, you're going to browse and you're going to select the certificate that you're using. So again, in our case, we took the root certificate from the Microsoft CE that's used just internally, and that's what we published. This way, any child certs that were spun off of that and used to sign apps are approved to launch on the devices. Now I'm going to take you to the desktop. This is what a modern app looks like. You can see in the naming convention that we use, it says any CPU. What that means basically is this Windows 8 application will run on x86, x64, and RT. So it's used across platform. So I publish it once in the console, deploy it out as available to my users, and no matter what device they're on, when they choose to install it, it installs. If I show you it right now, you can see there's a digital signature attached to this. And this is the child cert that it's been signed with, internal use only. And if we look at the details, you can see the certificate chain goes back to the internal corporate root. And so this is the root certificate that the child cert was pulled off of. So one of the things you can do is kind of a pre-check prior to you publishing the application in Config Manager is just take a look at this signature and make sure that it's correct for your environment before you go ahead and publish it. Because if it's not, you're going to end up having users that are disappointed that the apps don't work, and you're going to pull it back anyways. So how does the signing process work? There's these tools that are provided to you as part of the Windows 8 deployment toolkit. And the SDK basically takes advantage of these command lines. Let's make sure I get the right one. So let's say as a developer, I go in and I decide I want to take a look at my MS Time Off app that I did. So what I've done using that Make App tool is unpacked my actual application. And if you look at the App Manifest XML, it's giving you the information on what this app is currently signed with. So you can see the certificate path inside. When the developer finishes developing his app and testing it, he's going to basically compile it back up. So by recompiling this app, I've created a new package, appx. So essentially what this is the same file that I just unpacked. I've repacked it just with a new name. What you'll notice now is there's no digital signature. So this app needs to be signed. If you try and deploy it as is, it's not going to work. Even though the information about the certificate is inside the manifest file, the app actually needs to be signed. And if I show you, this is how you do it. The other utility provided sign tool, you're using this command line. And this, MyCertPFX, is just a dummy name for a certificate that we use. So this would be the child certificate that you use for signing your apps. And once you sign it, you need to make sure that you're timestamping the apps as part of this command line. If you don't timestamp the app, when the child certificate expires and has to be renewed with no timestamp on it, all of the applications that are currently deployed to the client machines will stop functioning. As long as there's a timestamp on there, the root certificate will get updated. Those apps will continue to work. You don't have to worry about it. So it's key, even though you can sign it without a timestamp and deploy these out and have these work initially, you want to make sure you're timestamping them as part of the process so that they continue to work even after the certificate expires. Go back to The next topic we're going to cover is AppV. How many people are using AppV? Want to, okay, that's good. So there's a lot of concern from people who are currently using AppV because the version that's out there pre-SP1 is AppV 4.6 SP1. That doesn't work with Windows 8. You need to upgrade to 4.6 SP2 in order to support Windows 8. You don't need to upgrade to version 5 in order to run on a Config Manager SP1 environment. But you do get new features. The nice thing what the AppV team did was allowed both 4.6 SP2 and AppV 5.0 to run in coexistence on the same device. So in the past, you couldn't run two different AppV clients together. In this instance, you can. So it gives you a path in order to migrate over to the new AppV 5 functionality without having to figure out how quickly do I have to resequence all my applications or redeploy them out to my environment. So basically, you get your current 4.6 SP1 clients upgraded to SP2 so that it'll work with the SP1 environment. It doesn't add any new functionality. It's just in order to support Windows 8 desktops. If you want to, there's a utility that will allow you to convert all of your 4.6 SP2 packages to 5.0, so you don't have to do all the heavy lifting. In our environment, there's not a huge business case for AppV. We do use it because we're part of a partnership with the product team that develops it. We do use it in the environment, but we didn't have heavy usage of a lot of applications out there, so we didn't feel a lot of pain when we had to migrate. So it was much easier for me to just resequence applications to version 5 and deploy the client out. One of the key benefits you get from AppV 5.0 is the virtual environment. So in the old version of AppV, in order for a virtual app to speak to another virtual app, they had to be sequenced together into a single package. So if you had things like middleware, like .NET, or some plugins for IE or something else, you were constantly resequencing those same things into a single package. So now you're bloating up the size of your virtual applications because each one needed those things all sequenced together to work. With 5.0, the virtual environment now gives you the ability to say sequence.NET, sequence your application, and then set up a virtual environment inside the Config Manager console so those two applications can talk together. So it's really cool. So here's the sequence of what we did in our environment. We converted applications to 5.0, and again, this isn't something that you have to do. You can slowly migrate over time. We deployed the AppV 5.0 client through Config Manager. And I'll give you a tip. The AppV client 5.0 requires PowerShell 3 in order to function. PowerShell 3 requires a reboot in order for the AppV client to actually detect that it's installed. So we developed a pretty complex deployment set of application models that had dependency links to each other to not only get .NET framework installed and PowerShell, complete a reboot, and then come back up, install the AppV client, and then an application. We've developed that. It works great. At the end of this, I'm going to make sure that I put it in the available content, so anybody that does have AppV that wants to do an upgrade in their environment, you guys don't have to do all the heavy lifting. You can take this with you and test it out in your lab and make sure it works for you.
And this is only for non-Windows 8 machines, right, where the PowerShell 3.0 needs to be deployed?
Yeah, if you have a Windows 8 machine that already has PowerShell 3, then you're okay, it will pass. But we still had a lot of Windows 7 devices in our environment when we were moving to 5.0, and I'm sure there's lots of people out there that still have Windows 7 in their environment as well. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Arun to talk about Mac and device management, which I think there were quite a few people interested in.
There was a lot of enthusiasm for this initially, and we decided to give Mark a break since he's been talking for a while. So key feature, SP1, yes, you can support Macs. Earlier, you had to set up, you had to have enrollment points and enrollment proxy points, and the challenge we had was those had to be set up on the DMZ. You couldn't have anything on the corporate infrastructure. And we have a similar challenge as probably most folks have, that Macs are not domain joined. And surprisingly, actually, there are several units within Microsoft that use Macs. There is the Office for Mac team. There is recent acquisitions like Yammer and Skype, who really are attached to their Macs. We don't know why.
Yeah, we have well over 20,000 Mac devices on-premise that we hadn't been managing there because they're not even domain joined at this point.
Yeah. So one of the key things we did for being able to enroll these Mac devices or installing the SP1 agent, the Config Manager agent on them, is we had a user enrollment process. So this was something mandated from our security. So there are two different ways to enroll a device. You could do either system enrollment or user enrollment. But our security team felt since these devices are not domain joined, user enrollment was a more secure way to kind of, for asset tracking and trying to figure out who is actually joining these Macs to using the Mac in the Microsoft environment. So as part of that, it's a three-step process where we have an agent installation, we have a certificate enrollment, and then there's a reboot required. Unfortunately, there's no working around the reboot because in order for the Config Manager agent to function, you do have to perform the reboot. So we actually automated this process and have a shell script written which does the entire end-to-end process. So how many folks in here want that script? All right, you get one, you get one, you get one. At the end of this session, we have it at the end of the presentation. It's linked in the resources. So,
yeah. So if your Macs are on the domain, then it's going to be real easy for you. You'll just put it on a share, send out an email with the link to it, and the user will just run the shell script, and they don't have to do anything else. It'll install the client. It'll talk back to your certificate authority and get them a user cert, and then reboot their machine. So when all's said and done, it'll be an active reporting device in your Config Manager hierarchy. If they're not on the domain like ours, all we had to do was set up a boundary server share that allows them to connect and run it the exact same way. Nothing else special is needed. So either way, you're covered.
Yeah, and key features that come with SP1 for Mac management is, you were able to do policy enforcement and software distribution. Yeah. So we've deployed Skype and Skep software distribution, so we're able to enforce, have some kind of antivirus protection on these Mac devices. And at the same time, because these devices are not domain joined, some of the Active Directory enforced policies that we could not previously enforce, we're now able to enforce. And these are some of the policies that we've enforced at Microsoft IT. Possibly that, it's simple enough. I think it's the same. You can even use DCM, right?
Yes. So in order to manage these Mac devices and get policies on them, you're using desired configuration management just like you do for your desktops, just like you do for the modern devices that are in the cloud connected to Intune. Mac devices, same thing. There's out-of-box policies that are available to you to control anything that's exposed by Apple in the Mac OS so that you can select those and build these rules and just target it out. The key is to make sure that when you deploy these, you check the checkbox that says remediate non-compliant machines. If you don't check that checkbox, because a lot of people forget that one box, then all you're doing is evaluating, is the machine compliant to these configuration items that I've targeted to them? With the checkbox checked, it'll actually force the policy down on the machines and make them compliant.
So for some food for thought, some of the key benefits that we achieved and hopefully that you will achieve as well through this process is, being able to have an on-premise management for even managing Macs. Now, like we said, we had an explosion with the recent acquisitions at Microsoft of Yammer and Skype, and we've always had the Mac business unit who've been kind of, been under the radar, but now we have our eyes on them. And from a Config Manager admin perspective, Mark mentioned I worked on the platform side. It was an easy piece that we didn't have to work, with our data center team or security to try and set up something on the DMZ. Our enrollment point and device management point are on the corporate infrastructure. So user side challenges and key learnings that you probably have is, you have to work with your security team and possibly your certificate team, whoever manages the PKI infrastructure in your environment, to come up with those user certificate templates.
So the last point on the slide where it talks about change client settings using settings management. So on a Mac device, especially because this is the first foyer into having an on-prem Mac client, the settings for software deployment are not inherited as they are from the site for the rest of your managed clients. It's a policy that's local on the device. By default, we changed the setting for software deployment to 120 minutes. So if you target a piece of software to a Mac device, there is no such thing as optional versus mandatory. Anything you target at a Mac device is mandatory, regardless of what you set it to. So changing the deadline to 120 minutes at least gave the users 2 hours when something was targeted to them to finish what they were working on, save anything before it installed, especially if in the case of a required reboot, you don't want to reboot these guys with no kind of warning. We also changed the reboot delay to 60 minutes. So out of the box, it reboots immediately after the application installs if that's what's required. So we added it to run for 60 minutes so they at least get a warning countdown that the machine's going to reboot in 60 minutes. So essentially from end to end, they've got a 3-hour window to look after. You probably want to be more conservative on the way you do application deployment out the gate with your Mac users because they're already going to dislike you because they've never been managed before and now you know what's going on those machines. So you don't want to get them too irritated right out the gate.
Let's talk next about the unified device management. So we had a session, like we said earlier this morning, which spoke about, you know, the integration between Config Manager, SP1, and Intune, and how we're using it for device management. And with SP1, you know, we're now natively managing iOS devices, Windows Phone 8, Windows RT devices in our environment through that Intune connector that we've set up on Config Manager. It also gives you the ability to manage Android devices. Unfortunately, surprise, surprise, we don't have a lot of Android LOB applications developed at Microsoft. So there was nothing really to incite our end users to start enrolling their devices and, you know, start using, be managed under unified device management. So this is what we've managed to implement so far in our environment through unified device management. We have about currently 350 Windows Phone 8 and about 140 Windows RT. Based on our Exchange ActiveSync data, we're planning approximately 60,000 Windows Phone 8 and Windows RT devices to be enrolled pretty soon. And we're expanding that as we speak. Mm-hmm. From an LOB applications, we have 9 applications that have been published for Windows Phone 8 and 1 deep link tapped. I believe that's Skype.
Skype, yep.
And for Windows RT, we have a lot more because anything, like Mark showed, anything that works on a modern app that works on a Windows 8, x86, or x64 pretty much works seamlessly in our case on the Windows RT device. And we have 2 deep linked apps there. So let's talk about how this unified device management solution, you know, we have Windows PCs, Macs, that were, you know, we have Config Manager SP1 for. We had previously, we had Windows Phone, Android, and smartphone. We had that knowledge that these devices existed in our environment through Exchange ActiveSync. But now, we're able to manage, we're able to provide a unified solution, right? We have a we have the Config Manager still managing PCs and Macs. We have the Intune connector set up, which helps us manage the Windows Phone 8, Windows RT, and the iOS devices, and hopefully sometime in the future Android devices, but that's still out there. But from an administrative perspective, you know, nothing changes for us. We're still using Config Manager SP1 admin console. We're not having to log into the Intune account portal or the admin portal to manage anything. So that's a big plus for us. And also from an infrastructure perspective, we didn't have to set up any roles for these devices. We didn't have to set up anything on the DMZ or, you know, internet facing. We didn't have to register any internet facing DNS. We were just using an existing service. Like Intune is already a cloud-based service. A lot of users already use it. And folks can access it from their 3G connection or from their Wi-Fi connection at home. So from our perspective, all we had to do was set up the connector between an on-premise infrastructure and the cloud, and we've been good to go. So some of the other noteworthy items. Currently, the device from the devices we stand for, the devices that are enrolled through the Intune connector, there's a 100K limit. I don't know if that's official yet or if there are changes. So that constantly changes, so keep your eye out for that. There are the wipe and enforcement, the company portal, and wipe scenarios have been evaluated for the Windows Phone 8 and the RT devices. So actually, a lot of this information is actually available in our session that we did this morning. So we encourage you to watch that. It should be on Channel 9 by now. So that will give you a lot of the in-depth information that you need, including links to some of the troubleshooting documentation, the help desk smart guides that we came up with, that you can potentially use as templates and use in your environment. So with that, I hand back to Mark to talk about wake-up proxy implementation.
So this is the last feature that we're going to talk about today, unless anybody has questions about other features that we can talk about after the session. Wake-up proxy was kind of interesting for us. Most companies, does anybody here use Wake on LAN right now? Well, you guys are lucky, because most network admins hate Wake on LAN, and they won't let you turn it on. So wake-up proxy bypasses you having to spend a lot of time begging the network guys to let you have some form of ability to have remote people be able to wake up their machines when they're at home. So Microsoft has a pretty good go green policy where we've put fairly aggressive sleep or hibernation settings against our desktop machines. So we've got testers and developers that go home at the end of the day and they want to get back into their systems in order to check something out that they want to run over the evening. And they complained a lot that, hey, I'm at home and I can't get to my machine anymore, so please opt me out of your Go Green Power policy. And so we started losing adoption, which then means you're not getting the benefit from having machines offline when people aren't actually using them. With Wake Up Proxy, it's an agent that's essentially just sitting as part of the Config Manager SP1 client install, waiting to be turned on. You use a custom client agent to go and check a checkbox to say enable wake-up proxy, and then you target that to a collection of devices that you want to enable that, at which point that wake-up proxy agent is turned on. So we don't recommend that you go turn this on and target your entire environment right out the gate. You need to make sure that you're taking a look and find out what effect it has on your network. But the way it works is once those agents are turned on, within a subnet, three machines will always stay awake. It's a random three machines. There's an algorithm that determines who's going to be on at what time. And they manage a complete list of all the other machines that are in the environment. When those machines are turned off and an RDP request comes in, one of those management machines will intercept that request, basically, find out who it's for, and then send a wake-up request to that machine. And the RDP request will then go directly to that system. And as far as the end user is concerned, the machine's now awake again. So a machine goes straight from a sleep or hibernation state, gets woken up, and the end user who's triggered the RDP request doesn't know that anything was different. As far as they know, that machine's always been awake. So we did some testing, of course, in advance, because we had no idea how this feature was going to function. We use Direct Access. I don't know how many people use Direct Access versus VPN, but Direct Access, you just need to know what the gateway address is for your DA infrastructure, and that's submitted as part of creating the custom client agent for Wake Up Proxy. And we basically set this up and targeted 16,000 machines and watched network trace for a while and noticed that the baseline between not having it enabled versus having it enabled made really no difference. So there wasn't a huge load in our environment. But again, anything like this where you're possibly potentially impacting the network is something that you want to do slowly and make sure that you've covered all your bases. Don't go and just check it and turn it on for your entire hierarchy right off the gate. This is what the custom client device settings looks like. It's pretty simple, straightforward. And the food for thought, as I mentioned, three machines are always going to be awake on a subnet. So if one of the machines gets shut down, say it was my machine and I decide I'm going home for the day, I'm not letting it go to sleep, I'm actually just going to turn it off, or it's a laptop so I'm taking it home, before I actually shut down, I'll send out a request to one of the other machines that's awake on the network right now in my subnet and tell them, hey, you're now one of the three management groups, and then I'll shut down. And now they'll have the list of all of the other machines. So there will always be three machines on, unless, of course, there's not three machines left on your network. If everybody takes their laptop home, then it's not going to work for you. Ping on the network is actually used just to build that mapping. So it's used to ping out all the machines in the subnet and find out who's actually online so that if it does have to hand off the management role, it knows who it can go and communicate with. Sorry. And with that, I'll let Arun finish us up, and then we can take any questions people have.
All right. Some of the additional useful information resources. So SQL 2012, how many folks are in SQL 2012? That's a decent percentage. So Config Manager 2012, SP1 is supported on SQL 2012. I think a minimum of CU2 is required. And of course, not supported in SQL 2012 SP1. So I'm not sure how up-to-date that article is, because we've with CU1, I think you can run it on even SP1. So cumulative update. Folks who have already in SP1, how many are on C1? And we'd recommend that you actually update, if you're already in SP1, update to C1 as quickly as possible. It has a lot of bug fixes that would really help, and hot fixes that would really help you. And I know it's the most frustrating thing that you call support or somebody, and the first thing they would say is, are you on C1 yet? And then you're forced to upgrade. There's significant improvement for role-based access control. So how many folks actually use role-based access control in their environment? Just two. We recommend role-based access control, especially in scenarios where you want to do unified device management and you want to implement features such as wipe and retire. You don't want the wrong admin to accidentally wipe out like an executive's phone or device. Those are just, you know, career-limiting moves that you can help eliminate by implementing role-based access control in your environment. And we touched on this. There are some phenomenal PowerShell commandlets available in SP1 that let you do a lot of things and that actually give you a lot of rich information that previously you had to pull through from either WMI or through SQL queries that are just available out of box through the PowerShell commandlets. Pull distribution point, we actually did not invest a lot of time in, because this feature came on a little late in the life cycle of SP1. We didn't invest a lot of time towards this, but this is another great process or great solution for, saving on WAN traffic and also for saving on the number of threads. Say if you have a primary site that has multiple distribution points, you could set up pull DP so not everybody, like content replication happens. Not all DPs are trying to communicate with the primary site at the same point in time. It'll be like a peer process where, you know, you could set up chains where it's going to one DP and then the next DP is communicating and pulling the content from the peer DP. So that's something we recommend that folks evaluate, and if they want, it's another great feature. And it could also help you if you want to eliminate secondary sites in your environment. That's food for thought that, you know, you could actually implement a pull DP, and because a secondary site requires it, I think it installs the SQL database when it does a secondary site installation, and you could have a higher machine requirement or a VM requirement for running a secondary site versus just a distribution point. So by implementing, if all you're using the secondary site is for content compression, then using a pull DP could help you eliminate some of the secondary sites. And there's a new updated toolkit in SP1 added for, you know, which has great add-ons for content library transfer and can be downloaded from this link here. So the additional resources, we'll just click through this quickly so folks can look at the Mac enrollment script that a lot of folks are interested in is that it's on SkyDrive and it's linked to this presentation. In review, we hope that we gave you a good a perspective of from an IT admin perspective of, you know, some of the cool features in SP1 that you hopefully you do get encouraged to go ahead and go implement or explore in your environment. And I'm not going to waste too much time. We'll just go directly to the last slide where we want you to scan the track and give us feedback on how we did. We're looking for this scan code. So please do give feedback because that really helps us and improve our our presentation skills, and from a content perspective gives us valuable feedback on what customers are really looking for. So with this, we're open for questions.